The Oracle Network.
Riddle Me That is a true crime podcast that deals with adult themes. Some episodes explore disturbing topics such as murder, abuse, sexual violence, drug abuse, suicide, and self-harm. Please listen at your own risk. Theories discussed in episodes may not be the opinion of the host.
Welcome back to part two of our coverage on Darlie Root here. I'm again joined by Dana from That Trophy Wife Life podcast. Let's get right back into it. So Darlie's at the hospital around 3:30 a.m. and she starts her surgery to repair her neck wounds a few minutes before 4 a.m. and it's finished in 45 minutes at 4:35 a.m. Over the next few days, deep bruises would appear on Darlie's arm. Some of the medical personnel believe that she may have done it to herself. Personally, I don't see how, but the bruises are weird. They don't seem to be in the shape of hands or fingers as one might expect. What were your thoughts on the bruises?
Well, I guess if people think that she's willing to slit her own throat, then she probably has no qualms about banging herself up too.
It just seems so weird, right? Like it was seemed to be suggested by certain people that she would have been grabbing at herself in the hospital bed and that's why the bruises took so long to appear. But again, I think we would see very clear hand, basically, we'd see her fingers and her hands because she can't just go all about the hospital room banging into things with nobody noticing. So,
yeah.
And while staging the scene, would you think to also bruise yourself? Like I could see thinking to cut yourself, but thinking to do something like bruise yourself that would appear later, like either she's a criminal mastermind or potentially somebody did this to her.
Yeah. See, again, it's like, I guess it depends on how well thought out somebody put the effort into doing something like that. I mean, it doesn't seem likely, but crazier things have happened.
Darlie also sustained a fairly serious wound to her arm. It was a cut that went so deep, it actually hit the bone. And that's pretty hard to do to yourself. Like, I mean, I suppose it's possible, but it does seem to be pretty difficult. So we'd have to believe that Darlie not only did this slicing neck wound, nearly nicking her carotid artery with her non-dominant hand, but she also went on to deeply slice her arm. It's possible, but it just seems incredibly painful.
Yeah, I definitely couldn't do it myself. I'm a big wimp, but I mean, I guess it's possible.
I mean, anything's possible, but it just seems to be incredibly painful. And like, if we're to accept that she did this, which wound did she inflict upon herself first? And you would think after that first wound, whether it be the neck or the arm, it would be incredibly painful and there would be so much blood that one would then stop. To just continue to injure oneself after that, it seems hard to grasp.
Yeah, I agree.
So the demeanor and affect of Darlie in the hospital is called into question as well. Some of the doctors and nurses seem to support that she was emotional, sad, upset, but others seem to counter that where they believe that something wasn't right or she wasn't upset enough. So we have a bit of an observation problem in that it almost seems impossible to take any of this as evidence to make you lean one way or the other. We always have this bias, like this idea of how people would respond to trauma. And there is no clear path or one way. So in my opinion, the diametrically opposed opinions of medical personnel speaks to the paradigm or lens through which they view Darlie as a victim or perpetrator. This is subjective, not objective. Therefore, we can take it into consideration, but how much weight it should carry, given the differing opinions, personally, I don't give it much.
Yeah, I agree. Especially, I mean, she just lost her children. Shock could be playing a role in that. I don't think that we should give that too much weight either.
No, the thing was what people were saying too, like nurses and stuff were saying one thing, like about her affect and demeanor later, like, oh, she was behaving this way and it was super suspect. But then their notes said the complete opposite thing. So it was sort of like this was added later to further a narrative, whether it was sort of like the more they talked amongst themselves and they decided on this conclusion or whether law enforcement pushed it. I'm not really sure why their notes weren't in alignment with what some of them were saying. But either way, it just, to me, it didn't make me lean one way or the other. I just kind of threw out all of that evidence because they were so opposed.
Yeah, especially when it comes with stuff that is objective like that. I mean, for me, I want to see the hard stuff.
Yeah, it was just a little bit too much everybody's opinion on what they thought of Darlie. And I think it became pretty clear. And I also have a problem when someone's notes aren't lining up with what they're saying later. It's like, you're saying that she's behaving in a way that's typical and she's a mother that's mourning, but then later you're calling it into question. Are you then calling it into question because of what the news has put out there and the stories you've then heard about Darlie? So then your testimony reflects this bias. So we might see some of that going on as well.
Yeah. And people don't even realize they do that sometimes.
Oh, totally. I don't think it's malicious on the part of most people. I just think that eyewitness and ear witness testimony is incredibly inaccurate for the most part, because our memories as human beings are not as accurate as we like to think.
I know. Yeah.
So Darlie's neighbors seem to come forward and paint her as this terrible mother who didn't love her children. There's so much mom shaming going on here. It's impossible to tell how much it was just this really young mom trying to do her best and how much Darlie was actually being a, quote, bad mom.
So, like, what happened? What were they saying she was doing?
Okay, so apparently there was a party and one of the boys innocently squirted Darlie with a water gun, as kids do. And she was so angry that she kind of smushed a piece of cake in his face and allegedly said to him after that he deserved it.
Okay. I mean, I don't know. If my kid was squirting me with a water gun, I might smash some cake in his face.
I mean, I can't think that this one thing in isolation makes her a bad mom. I mean, I think all moms have something they're not proud of that they've done, whether or not this went down like this witness said it did. And we have to accept, you know, that this person is being accurate the way they're telling the story. And Dana and I talked about this before we recorded. Perhaps this person saw these two events happen and thought they were happening in succession. But actually, it was like, oh, he squirted Darlie with the water gun. And then she got mad at him. And then minutes later, they were joking around. She pushed his face in the cake and said, haha, you deserve it. Right? So it just depends on how you interpret that.
Exactly. And I know, at least for me and my boys, my teenagers, we joke around with each other all the time and they'll jump out from behind doors and scare the crap out of me. And I'm hitting them like, oh my God, why did you do that to me? And then, you know, 10 minutes later, I'm doing the exact same thing to them. So I think maybe they just had a playful relationship.
So neighbors seem to come forward in droves to talk about how they know who did it and that it was Darlie. But friends and family said Darlie was a really good mom. And I think there may have been some potential jealousy or some othering going on. Darlie was attractive. And by all accounts, the couple did do kind of these ostentatious displays of wealth, the jewelry, the boat, the vacations, the shopping, the list goes on. And some people find that distasteful. And those same people may potentially be those exact people who are pointing the finger at Darlie.
Yeah, I think a lot of judgy people, especially whenever you have a young couple, because that always makes people judge a little bit harder when they see your young face and you have all this money. That could definitely be a reason that somebody would say something like that.
Exactly. And if you've got a situation where she's being judged harshly already, there might be jealousy at play. And then you've got people to really get this chance to like really give it to her. You know what I mean? Like, she never deserved that, or she's this type of a woman. And it seems like that's what the neighbors were like. It's like, you liked her enough to go to her house for barbecues and to spend time with her. And now something like this happens and you're all too ready to turn around and point the finger and be like, she's a terrible mother. She's a child killer. It's like, she was obviously your friend enough that you'd go to her house.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And now they're like, we knew all along.
Exactly. So on June 9th, there is a somber funeral in which Devin and Damon are buried together. This just breaks my heart. The boys were buried together holding hands.
That is gut-wrenching.
I know. It's one of those things about the case that just, it really stuck with me. I don't know why. It's not like they showed a picture of it, but I just have this visual in my head of these two little boys in the casket with these kind of interlocking fingers. And it's both disturbing and upsetting, but it's also beautiful that these two boys got to go to their final resting place together.
Yeah, I agree.
So now we need to touch on the silly string graveside. I don't know what to call it. Party, celebration, gathering.
What is that about?
Okay, so this is a video that I think was watched 9 times by the jury who heard the case in Texas in 1997. On a side note, they took only 8 hours to deliberate. So you can imagine this jury just sitting around hating on Darlie for 8 hours, watching this video over and over again. And I'm not saying that she's innocent, just that this video is extremely prejudicial. The jury knew this woman was fighting for her life, and this is Texas. And it took them only an 8-hour workday to find her guilty. It's beyond me. They must have been very resolute in their opinions that Darlie did it.
Yeah, and so was she charged with both of the murders?
So this part's really confusing because some believe that it's sort of like double jeopardy, but the state chose to charge Darlie with one of the murders and not both. So they charged her with the murder of 5-year-old Damon because they wanted a second bite at the apple if they failed the first time.
Oh, so like stacking the deck.
Sort of. There is another reason that we'll get to later, which may be why they only charged
Darlie with Damon's murder and not with Devin's.
And they just didn't want to fully admit that this is the reason because it just raises so many questions. So put a pin in that. So the silly string festivities were filmed by family. It wasn't Darlie who bought the silly string. It was her sister and brother-in-law who bought it. It was Devin's birthday and Devin loved silly string. They thought Devin would love the celebration. So Darlie agreed. Darlie is with family and friends. Keep in mind, this isn't just Darlie on her own. Everyone looks jovial and Darlie's spraying silly string along with her sister. She's smiling and chewing gum with her mouth open in that like smacking kind of way. So many people take issue with this. And look, if it was only Darlie, yes, it would be problematic. But it looks like the entire family made the decision to celebrate the life of the boys. And the jury just used this as a nail in her coffin. And it was clear that they weren't a fan of Darlie at this point.
Yeah, but we just said, though, that they also had a somber funeral.
Yeah. And years later, it came to light that on the same day, that 2-hour somber memorial was held at the gravesite of the boys, and it was secretly captured on CCTV by the police. But it seems that they never released this to the defense, or if they did, it was just a data dump where they could never find it in time to use it. So the silly string video is extremely prejudicial on its own, but in the context of both videos, it's framed more appropriately. Darlie can be seen appearing to be genuinely upset as she mourns the loss of her sons.
Wow, that's like my mind is blown by that.
I know. This is one of the things that upsets me the most because when you look at that silly string video, it can seem really strange. I mean, I know people do strange things with grief and I'm less inclined to judge it probably than the jury would have been even in the initial stages. I'm more inclined to judge other things, like maybe the weird things that she says with the 911 or the footprints under the glass than I would be to judge how somebody chooses to celebrate life or grieve. But the fact that they weren't given the option to see both videos and then form their own kind of interpretation of her emotional state is, it's just so unfortunate because it would have been, I think, a completely different outcome.
Yeah, I agree because honestly, just hearing about her throwing a party at the gravesite with silly string, that's weird. I'm like, what? That, I mean, it's what, less than a week or a week later that they were burying them? That's, I would still be devastated, I think. I don't know for sure. But then to know that, no, they did just previously have that. She got to grieve and then she got to celebrate. Like those two things hand in hand make a lot more sense and make it seem less weird.
Yeah, absolutely. So at Darlie's trial, the two lead detectives were asked about this memorial video and why it wasn't made available to the defense. And they pled the fifth. Can you believe that?
What? And, yeah. And what about the jury?
So the jury was not a fan of Darlie's look, her shopping, her vacations. Of course, the bleached blonde hair and breast implants. I saw one of the jurors speak on a documentary that I saw years ago, and her name was Carrie Paris. It was the one thing that stood out to me. So this woman was basically chastising Darlie for her lifestyle because it was far removed from those of the jury. She pointed out the breast implants and basically said that this wasn't something I would do. And this just shows how harshly Darlie was being looked at by the jury. I mean, it's supposed to be a jury of your peers.
And was this a jury of her peers in Kerrville, Texas?
I would say no, definitely not.
Yeah, it very clearly is not.
And on a side note, in the Death Row Stories documentary, one of the jurors, Charlie Sanford, speaks out about the two videos, saying that he would have looked at Darlie completely differently if he'd seen the video of the memorial. But instead, they were shown only the Silly String video. And in the minds of pretty much anyone who looks at this case, if you believe Darlie is innocent or not, this is extremely prejudicial.
Extremely. It still blows my mind.
Yeah, it blows my mind too. It feels like a total miscarriage of justice. It feels like a Brady violation. Like, why aren't you giving the defense the opportunity to present this? You got this on CCTV. You have this information. You know what it's going to look like to the jury, only showing the Silly String, not showing the memorial. And you did this on purpose. And it just feels wrong.
It's actually a little terrifying that it could happen. Like, it's terrifying that somebody can just make the decision and you are supposed to have a trial with a jury, but the decision's already been made. It's like she didn't stand a chance.
Yeah, I agree. She didn't from the outset. It was like, okay, we're going forward with this evidence and we're not going to share anything that might be helpful to the defense. And we're going to, you know, present a very clear narrative, and anything that doesn't support our narrative, we're basically going to throw away or we're going to bury so the defense doesn't have access to it. And unfortunately, it just appears very one-sided.
Yeah, it does.
Also, the prosecutors, Greg Davis and Toby Shook's motive was weak in the opinion of many. That Darlie just decided to kill her sons for financial reasons. I mean, this is a woman who, by their accounts, cares very much about appearances. So what would make her believe that she could successfully pull off a murder, then staging it to make it look like an intruder did it? Wouldn't people judge her and wonder if she did it? This seems like an act that would invite people to look down on you as a possible murderer.
Yeah, that is a weird thing for them to think. And then also for financial reasons, though, like what is it, offing her kids so she doesn't have to feed them so she can buy more jewelry?
I guess. And it's like the life insurance policies on the boys, they did have them, but they were just the normal amount that would cover the expenses of a funeral. So I don't really get that either as a motive. They both feel really weak to me and incomplete.
Yes.
Just on a side note, these prosecutors, Davis and Shook, shamed Darlie for everything, from her appearance and alleged greed and selfishness to her choices of music at the Silly String celebration. So for anyone listening, she played Coolio's Gangster's Paradise. This was a popular song at the time, and I'm sure it's a curious choice, but is that something worth shaming Darlie over? Personally, not in my opinion. People deal with grief differently, and if the family wants to listen to Coolio, let them.
Yeah, and you know, I also read that their son loved that song, and he used to dance to it all the time. He was a kid. He didn't really understand the words to the song, but he liked the beat.
That's so cute. I didn't know that. So that provides even more context. Of course, they wanted to play a song that he loved. Okay, so back to the motive that Dana and I just briefly touched on. I don't know. It's so difficult to grasp that this could have been for financial reasons because, like we said, very little life insurance. And, you know, how much does it cost to feed three kids? Sure, it costs a decent amount, but I mean, it just doesn't seem likely. And I can only fathom that if Darlie did indeed do this, that it was during a moment of instability, postpartum depression, a mental health crisis that caused her to act emotionally and impulsively, potentially wanting to end her own life and the life of her children because she felt like she couldn't go on. Again, we cannot know. Only Darlie knows. I just have a hard time with this money as a motive for killing the boys. But we also have a problem, like Dana and I have mentioned, and it is important to emphasize, if this was the reason, why kill two and not three?
Yeah, that makes absolutely no sense to me.
No, it makes no sense. And guess how much life insurance was on Darren?
What is it? 1996-ish?
Yeah.
Okay, so what, 250?
No, there's almost $1 million on Darren, so $800,000. So that would be like $1.6 million now, maybe $1.4. So a lot of money. That's a pretty high insurance policy. So if Darlie was doing this because she was greedy, that would be the most lucrative way to go about it, to kill her husband. Also, one could make the argument that Darlie doesn't work and Darren is her sole source of support financially. So to kill him could be akin to killing the goose who lay the golden egg. Again, not my opinion, just one perspective.
Yeah, but that still doesn't make sense for the kids because there is no financial motivation there.
Yeah, I can't grasp a financial motive that like you don't want to clothe them or feed them. You know, it doesn't make any sense. You're only going to get enough money for their funerals. So I don't get that. The only thing that I could grasp is if she was in a mental health crisis, potentially she could have acted in a way that was outside of herself. But I still have difficulty with that as well. So one thing I find strange is that Darren was going to be named by Darlie's original lawyer as an alternate suspect in the murder. And this isn't as serious as it sounds. You need a credible suspect, and Darren looks like he could create reasonable doubt. He did have a life insurance policy on Darlie. I think it was $250,000. So this could solve his financial worries. If, for example, he'd grown tired of his depressed wife and she was overspending, again, not saying this is a fact, just trying to understand the approach the original attorney would have taken.
So why didn't they use him as a suspect?
So I don't know at what point Darren's attorney, Douglas Mulder, who might I add, charged the family $250,000 and had recently represented Darren in a gag order case. So there was a conflict of interest. I guess that's the question.
Yeah, that number keeps popping up too, huh? $250,000.
I know, right? It's the amount that was on Darlie's life insurance on her and then the amount that he's getting paid. So I don't know. I think it's just so weird that given the large sum of money that he was demanding, that he didn't raise Darren as a suspect. Darlie was facing the death penalty, and it was her very best chance. And there was, according to Death Row Stories, a conversation between Darren and Mulder not to raise Darren as a suspect. It made no sense to both Darren and Darlie's families. He wasn't on trial. That's what you do for reasonable doubt. You raise another credible suspect. If he had nothing to do with this, why would he be so opposed if this was his wife's best shot at going free?
Well, I mean, you could look at this one of two ways. Maybe he thought she did it. Or maybe he was just too afraid that they'd actually investigate further.
It's so weird because he's such an ardent supporter of Darlie for so many years. But it's like, are you just supporting enough so that you appear like you're being supportive outwardly, but when it comes down to it, you're not willing to put your butt on the line and be raised as a suspect?
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people have brought up the fact that Mulder did not raise Darren as a suspect and that he had represented him before. So do you have a conflict of interest? Because are you trying to protect Darren and Darlie? You need to be looking out for only Darlie, but it seems as though he was trying to protect Darren. And that in and of itself is flawed.
Yeah, that's definitely a conflict of interest.
So it wasn't just the public that questioned if Darren could have been involved. Even Sandy Atkin, Darren's aunt, had some questions about his potential involvement. She said something about how in her heart or her gut, she knew he didn't do it, but her brain had some questions. Fair play, Sandy. I too have some questions.
Yeah, there's lots of questions surrounding this case.
So in the other documentary I mentioned that is slanted more anti-Darlie, Family Secrets, True Crime Scene, Season 1, Episode 4, they do bring up some curious incidents alleging that Darren Routier threatened to kill himself with a gun on one occasion.
So was there any history of abuse there? Did he ever threaten her?
So according to the documentary, yes. On one occasion, Darren does threaten Darlie with a gun, reportedly holding it to her head and basically telling her to never leave him. This is really scary, and if it's indeed true, it opens up the possibility that there was some sort of domestic violence or coercive control in the relationship, because holding a gun to your partner's head is never okay.
No, that's not okay. And with that being said, it does make me think, like, you have children that have been stabbed multiple times. 6 times one of them was stabbed, and that seems like excessive for a child sleeping on the floor. And then she also has some wounds. It's curious to me that nobody thought to talk about him doing it.
Yeah, I don't know why it seemed to be dismissed so early and Darren wasn't, you know, dug into more. It was like, oh, he was sleeping upstairs. He couldn't have done it. I'm not sure why Darren as an avenue of inquiry wasn't pursued more heavily. And even if just to raise it at trial, as an alternative suspect, it doesn't mean he's going on trial or he will ever be charged. It's just she's facing the death penalty here. She's fighting for her literal life. You would think that you would want to give your wife the very best chance. And outwardly, he's saying Darlie's innocent. She's a good mom. She would never do this. But yet you're not willing to put your butt on the line. That bothered me. It's always bothered me.
Oh, yeah. That's very curious.
So Darren also apparently failed 3 polygraphs. It's been referred to as 1 and 3. I think it was from the same 4 questions asked 3 times, each time hoping for a different result. From what I understand of polygraphs is the person administering the polygraph should typically be asking the same question over and over in different ways. And it should never just be this quick 4 questions. So with each question being slightly altered with the wording each time, not the exact same one 3 times. But again, I'm a little unclear what exactly went on at this polygraph examination, as I've seen it described by investigators in 2 ways. I personally don't think polygraphs are reliable, but in this context, it's interesting. The individual who performed the polygraph seemed so convinced of Darren's guilt that he tried to elicit a confession, obviously to no avail.
Yeah, that is interesting. And I agree that I don't think that polygraphs are super reliable. However, I do think that they can kind of point you in the right direction.
Yeah, and I think that's a great point. I think someone's willingness to take a polygraph, I think, can be indicative one way or the other. Like, I always think of the Chris Watts case. Did you watch that documentary on Netflix?
Yes.
Did you see when he got strapped into that polygraph? And the examiner was good. She's like, I'm going to know if you're lying as soon as... It was just the anxiety of the polygraph that he started confessing.
Yeah, yeah. It's a mind game.
Yeah, absolutely. So Darren looks even worse years later when he comes forward saying he was involved in insurance scams and he planned to do one on his home and admitted to one involving his car. He wasn't saying this was a result of that, but it does seem possible that he may have involved the wrong people who broke in at the wrong time. And instead of stealing, they panicked and killed the family. Darlie on the Death Row Stories documentary cries when she shares a story. And her emotion, like this utter heartbreak and betrayal, in my opinion, as I said earlier, it appears genuine. Investigators raise the possibility if Darren was involved with another unknown assailant, again, this is just a theory, there's only circumstantial evidence to tie Darren and no forensics that point to him as the killer.
That's really hard because, you know, if you are the person that's sitting on death row and you don't know what happened to your kids and there seems to be no answers being given.
Yeah, it's super, super frustrating, right? Like she's stuck there. There's very little she can do. And I can only imagine what it would be like to hear this information for the first time when you're sitting behind bars. This could have been helpful during her trial. Yet this is another thing that Darren didn't offer up that could have been reasonable doubt. But yet he neglected to put that forward until it was too late.
Yeah, this guy has a nasty habit of doing that.
Yes, he definitely seems to. Darren also doesn't seem to hear anything until he comes running downstairs. So at that point, Darlie's on the 911 call. I looked at the layout of the house and it was large, so it's possible that he just didn't hear. Or it's possible, as one of those theories, that he was involved somehow in that he and another individual perpetrated the attack. But again, there's no concrete evidence at this time of another individual in the Routier home.
So if there was an intruder, how did they get in?
Well, if there was an intruder, I think the intruder could have entered through a slit screen. So this could be interpreted in 2 ways. Those that support Darlie say the window is slit from the outside, and her detractors say there's fiber evidence to support that it was slit from the inside.
Well, what evidence was that?
So there was supposedly one single fiber from the screen, which critics of the evidence say one fiber is kind of preposterous. On ForensicFilesNow.com, they say that the Routier home wasn't hermetically sealed, so that one fiber just isn't enough. And I honestly just don't know what the answer to this question is.
So was the screen slit from the outside or the inside?
So they said it was slit from the inside on this knife from the butcher block. And if this knife slit the screen from the inside, then that means what?
The call is coming from inside the house.
Yes. So one other thing that is brought up is the lack of dust and mulch disturbance at the window where the perpetrator is alleged to have broken in. Experts have said that someone could have entered without disturbing this. So personally, this doesn't really seal the deal one way or the other for me.
Yeah, I agree. But I also feel like I kind of would expect to see some disturbance.
Yeah, I agree. And when I first looked at it, I was like, oh, weird. It's one of those things where you would have to disturb it coming in and out. But they had somebody go in and out of this window and one could very easily do it without disturbing this. So it could happen. And I think that was just the way they were framing it is this couldn't happen. it is possible. I don't know how likely it is. I think when you're attempting to do so without disturbing the mulch, and that's your objective, which would be during any recreation scene, because that's exactly what you're doing, trying to either prove or disprove this. So I don't know. It's difficult.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's another piece of the puzzle. See, I didn't know that part. I didn't know that they were, you know, trying to get in and out without disturbing it. So that makes much more sense.
I'm just assuming that the investigators, when doing a recreation, would have been attempting to do that. Like, it's hard not to establish it and just to go in without the objective being to prove one way or the other, right? Like, are you going in without this narrative in your mind already when doing the recreations? Are you just trying to use this to therefore support what you've already found, aka Darley is the perpetrator? Or are you going in and you're just trying this multiple ways and you're doing so from, and you're trying to be as objective as possible? We can't really know the answer there, but it's tough because we have both sides doing them, right? I don't know. Darley's side would be approaching it like, okay, we're trying not to disturb it. And then I think the police doing a recreation would be almost trying to disturb it, because you can't help but put your bias onto that recreation, I would think. I don't know. What's your take on that?
No, I agree with you, because there are two sides that are doing this. And so, yeah, it's one side's going to be, you know, trying really hard to prove it, and the other side's going to be trying really hard to disprove it. And I think that if one side can prove that you can get in and out without disturbing it, then I kind of feel like that's it, because you just did it.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I think that's definitely possible. So it's alleged that two knives were used to fatally wound Devin and Damon on darleyslastdefense.com website, which I'll link in the show notes. Whichever way you fall, if you think Darley is innocent or guilty, there's a plethora of information, photos, court transcripts, autopsy reports on the boys, etc. Okay, so back to the knife. Only one knife was found at the scene with the boys' blood. So this is compelling, and something like the sock that Darley supporters point to when they say that there was an intruder.
So what about the blood on Darley's clothes?
So Tom Bevel was the expert from the defense, and on DarleyFacts.com, they point out that the National Academy of Sciences doesn't consider it to be an objective or hard science. It is subjective and therefore is something open to interpretation, and that in and of itself is a problem. So Bevel found the blood of both boys on Darley's shirt. He concluded that due to the mix, it meant Darley had to have been bleeding when the boys were stabbed. Again, not quite sure how to draw this conclusion, in that, is the blood enough to tell us who was stabbed first? I'm not an expert, but I wouldn't think so, especially not in 1997 when the trial took place.
Yeah, I wouldn't think that either.
There was another problem with Darley's bloody shirt. It was reportedly cut off of her and put in a bag before it was allowed time to dry. So in theory, blood could have transferred from, you know, one spot on the shirt to another. So we may not be getting an accurate representation of blood spatter based on the shirt alone. It's just something to consider.
Yeah, just another piece of that puzzle.
Yeah. So as far as Bevel goes, on DarleyFacts.com, they state that Bevel said the number of stains may get in the way of his ability to interpret directionality in a meeting. But what he said on the stand was different, or what was referred to as materially different. Bevel stated that he was absolutely sure of his findings with regards to the contributors and cast-offs. It is questionable when an expert seems to go from a place of the evidence is a bit murky or cloudy to I can state yes, absolutely. Not even there's a high probability, which is used in hard science. And this is subjective blood spatter analysis, yet he's stating this like it's a fact. So this, of course, bothers me.
Yeah, that's really kind of bothering me too.
It appears that he says that all three, Darley, Devin, and Damon's blood were on the knife. But here's the very curious thing. Only Darley and Damon's blood was on the knife. Where was Devin's blood? That means there must have been another knife used. I've read this in a different way through a few sources. And this is interesting because, as we'll discuss later, Darley is charged with Damon's murder and not Devin's. I mean, there's no bloody murder weapon with Devin's blood, so this would be far more difficult to prove. One last issue with this shirt was chain of custody or chain of evidence. Bizarrely, the evidence wasn't dropped off at the police station, but the fire station. It's just one more issue to add to the long list of grievances about the evidence in this case.
Yeah, that's a weird thing there. Why would it go to the fire station?
Yeah, I have no idea how this even happened. Like, how does one make a mistake when this is crucial evidence in a murder case? And I know this was 1997, but I think they knew even then, you don't drop this off at the fire station. I just don't get how an error like this was made.
No, it's just one of many.
Other experts who've looked at the evidence believe there should have been more cast-off spatter on Darlie's shirt if she was indeed the murderer. Her shirt was covered in blood, but mostly her own. Is this conclusive evidence that she didn't do it? No, but it's just one more thing to consider. We should quickly address Darlie's pillowcase. She was supposedly lying down when she was awoken and struggled with her attacker. Yet the state suggests that she cut herself with the knife at the sink. While the blood on the pillowcase, according to some experts, supports the assertion that Darlie did indeed have her throat cut on the pillow like she stated. Does this explain all of the blood in the sink and why it's there? No, but again, just one more thing.
Yeah, and the fact that there is blood on the pillowcase says a lot to me, because if she cut herself at the sink, then why would there be blood on the pillowcase?
Exactly. It just seems to support Darlie's version of events, and it seems like it was written off, which I find weird. Again, it's sort of like the memorial video, right?
Yeah. And also, I mean, whenever you're a person that is injured and you're up and moving around, aren't you bleeding more anyways? Like, if you were at the sink and you were running around, isn't your heart like pumping it out more and you're bleeding more?
I think so. I mean, I'm not a medical doctor, but I do believe that you would be once you're moving around, because your heart is pumping at a slower rate when you're laying at rest. Yeah, like when you're laying on the couch at rest or when you're sleeping or in a relaxed state, it would be pumping less than when you're up and moving around, you know, at rest versus working out. But I mean, at this point, her heart's got to be pumping a million beats a minute because her anxiety, all of her stress hormones got to be dumping into her system as she's in this fight or flight type mode, I would think. But yeah, I don't know. I would think she would just start to bleed more. And maybe when she got up, it just, because her head is laying back, maybe just the weight of her head pushing forward on her neck caused her neck to bleed more.
Yeah, I'm just trying to figure out the why people are so hung up on the sink. And I feel like if she was at the sink trying to get towels and stuff like that, it's possible that she was just bleeding more while she was standing up rather than when she just first got cut.
Yeah, it doesn't really make me lean one way or the other. It doesn't seem to be adequately explained. And it does seem to be kind of bizarre. But again, the fact that there is blood on the pillow that does seem to support Darlie's version of events is interesting.
Mm-hmm. Agree.
Yeah. And like, this pillow was brought up at trial by Darlie's defense attorney, Richard Mostey, when questioning Charles Lynch. So this is how the conversation went down verbatim. Quote, Mostey: now, did you ever see this maroon pillow? Lynch: yes, I did. Mostey: did you take that? Lynch: no, I didn't. Mostey: who collected that? Lynch: that was collected by Rowlett Police Department. Mostey: and it had blood. It had, this maroon pillow had blood on both sides of it, didn't it? Lynch: right. End quote. I mean, this proves, yes, indeed, there was blood on the pillow. And this potentially supports Darlie's version of events, like we've said.
Yeah, I agree.
One thing that's worth to point out regarding the sock that we spoke of early on, just to refresh your memories, is it was found, I just checked, exactly 75 feet away from the home in the alleyway. Investigators hypothesized that Darlie went through the garage to plant the sock in the alleyway, and there was none of her blood. So we then have to believe that Darlie killed the boys, then planted the sock evidence, and then went back to the sink to cut her throat. This seems time consuming. Like, is it possible? Sure. I don't know how likely it is, given the gravity of the injuries suffered by the boys. I don't think it's possible that Darlie could have cut her throat, then planted the sock, because there would have been blood in the garage. The garage is the focal point because Darlie said the perpetrator exited through the garage.
So where would someone have had to exit the property?
Yeah, so the investigators checked into Darlie's version of events and they found no evidence of blood in the garage. Or when they checked the back gate, there was twine holding it closed. So there was no evidence that anyone had made an escape the way that Darlie claimed the attacker fled, or at least not in a way that disturbed the gate. And okay, so if this is totally accurate, there is some contradictory information about the blood in the garage.
And what was that?
So Charles Lynch said that he did indeed observe blood in the garage under cross-examination at Darlie's bond hearing. So Lynch said that James Cron said that the blood had not been there previously, meaning that one of the investigators or EMTs must have tracked the blood there. That also brings us to the footprint.
Ooh, whose footprint?
Okay, so this is a bit confusing. What it means, I can't say for sure. Firstly, let me say that Darren and Darley had bare feet when police arrived, and their shoes were checked for blood, and there was none found. It was only a partial shoe print, and some said that it matched the heel of Walling's shoe. Insofar as I know and have read, Darley's defense hasn't made public their efforts to include or exclude Walling as the contributor of the footprint. There also would have been described as possible shoe prints close to Devin's body. I've seen the photos, and it's definitely possible that these prints were in fact made by shoes or boots, but it's on carpet and no tread pattern can be seen. So I personally could go either way.
Yeah. What about the boys? How are their injuries relevant to the timeline?
Okay, so Damon was alive when paramedics arrived, and Darley was on the phone for 6 minutes. So given his injuries, doctors said he likely wouldn't have lived any longer than 8 minutes. So what, that gives Darley a minute or two to stage the scene? That seems pretty tight, especially given the sock is found 75 feet away. Unless the assessment by the medical examiner of the injuries and how long they believed Damon would live was off. And that's definitely possible as well. It's totally a subjective interpretation, not a fact. I think if you asked 10 medical examiners how long he would have lived, you'd get 10 different answers.
Yeah, there's just no way to know.
So the problem here is, like we've mentioned, the police seem to have tunnel vision. I'm not saying that this tunnel vision was wrong and that Darley was innocent. There just seems to be so much reasonable doubt and errors in her case that have not been addressed in a meaningful way. One example is a court transcriber who made egregious errors when transcribing, and this usually would be enough for an individual to get a new trial. But Darley still sat on death row. And when I say errors, I mean like tens of thousands of errors. And when this woman is questioned under oath, guess what she does?
I'm afraid. What'd she do?
She does what the detectives did. She pleads the fifth. So now we've got two lead detectives pleading the fifth when asked why they didn't make the graveside memorial tape available for evidence to the defense, or basically why they only showed the silly string video when they clearly had the other video, which would make the jury view Darley in a different light as a grieving mother. They pled the fifth, and now we have the court transcriber who's also pleading the fifth. This is just so bizarre.
That is super, super bizarre. So did they find any fingerprints?
Okay, so there were fingerprints found that didn't belong to Darren or Darley. This wasn't based on a full fingerprint. The fingerprint that was found was very smudged. And an expert was able to pull, I think, 7 or 8 points for comparison, which they said was enough to include or exclude individuals. And they were said to be adult size, but I also heard in one of the documentaries that they were the size of a 5 or 6 year old child. So like much of the information here, it does seem to contradict itself.
Yeah. And did they check the boys' fingerprints?
Yeah, there's a huge problem here. So the fingerprints of neither Devin or Damon were preserved. So investigators were at square one. They had nothing to compare them to unless those fingerprints were to get a hit on APHIS. The family did make the difficult decision to exhume the bodies of the boys so their fingerprints could be taken for comparison. But since the boys were buried with their fingers interlocked, holding hands, the prints weren't usable. And this part just breaks my heart.
Yeah, that is, wow.
Hairs were also found at the scene that didn't belong to the family. Well, without DNA testing, we don't know. We would need to eliminate everyone who visited the Routier home, such as family, friends, delivery people, anyone who may have left a trace of themselves behind. And from my understanding, though I could be wrong, this wasn't done. Those that support Darley keep trucking forward and hoping for more DNA testing, but this needs more funding, and it seems to be a very long, arduous, and protracted process. Darley was granted the right to a new testing in 2008. But nothing of note seems to have happened until 2018, where Criminal District Court Number 3 ordered a third round of DNA testing. But again, the results, if they've got them by now, are unclear.
Wow, that is just insane. So I was looking at some of the things that you had sent me, and they had said that they had sent the fingerprint again, because now that we are, you know, more technologically inclined, that they were sending it for testing again, but they haven't actually done it yet. Did I read that correctly?
Yeah, that's sort of what my understanding was too, that this was ordered in 2018 and why nothing seems to have happened. I mean, I didn't get any updates on any of these sites that have all this information about Darlie supporting any conclusions or even listing any sorts of conclusions or definitively saying that this testing has indeed happened.
Wow, that just seems really unfair.
It really does. And if she is innocent, can you imagine how frustrating that would be? Not only have you lost your boys, your marriage has fallen apart, everything in your life, and so many people think you're guilty, but yet all you want is to prove your innocence if she's indeed innocent. And then it just seems to take so many years to get any result when things like this court transcriber making so many errors, even that didn't get her a new trial. Like, she just must be at her wit's end.
Yeah. And so now I'm curious, because you had mentioned that the marriage was falling apart. Are Darlie and Darren still together?
So the two of them divorced in 2011. They actually stayed married for a really long time. And like I said earlier, Darren was a real supporter of Darlie's innocence. But after a certain amount of time, I think he just felt like his life was on pause and eventually chose to move on. I don't think, or, you know, wasn't by any appearances, it wasn't for a lack of love for Darlie, just coming to the realization that she may never be released from prison. And I can empathize. This would be incredibly difficult for Darren. He's lost his boys, his wife, and now he's kind of frozen on that night that they were killed. I can't judge him for his choice. I think it's totally natural, but, and there's definitely a but, I can't shake the nagging feeling that Darren, and I'm not saying he had anything to do with it, yet from what we've learned, something makes me look at him. Not that he did it necessarily, but just that he may know more than what he's sharing with investigators. Like, he was so slow to come forward with that information about insurance scams when it could have helped Darlie. So I don't know. I just feel like he's holding back.
Yeah. And I would assume that her family would have like thought something similar. Do you know what her family thought?
Yeah, this is really interesting. So on Death Row Stories, Darlie's mom says that she doesn't believe Darren would have either hurt her daughter or his kids. She seems to support Darren and says he's done a great job raising Drake, who makes an appearance in the documentary. And this just broke my heart. So Drake was diagnosed with cancer in, I think, 2014. It was a type of leukemia, and he had to tell Darlie over the phone. This obviously broke her heart.
Yeah, man. I mean, this family has gone through so much, and then you throw that diagnosis on top of that. That's really rough.
At least now Drake appears to be in remission, as his last cancer treatment was reportedly in 2016. So that's really good news. But my heart goes out to Drake, like, to have his brothers murdered and his mother on death row and suspicion cast on his father. He's truly such an innocent victim in all of this. And I truly hope that he finds peace amidst the chaos.
I really hope so, too. I mean, if there's any good thing to come out, it's that he was 7 months old and he will have absolutely no recollection of that night. But to go through his entire life with this as his story has to be really troubling.
Oh, I think it would weigh so heavily on an individual, right? Like, to know that everybody is going to be judging you as your mother was Darlie Routier and she killed your brothers. And that's the way that people are going to be looking at him. And I can only imagine what he's had to endure in his life. And my heart really breaks for him. And I really hope that, you know, he finds what he's looking for.
Oh, me too.
So one thing I brought up kind of quickly earlier, but I think we need to touch on in greater detail, is the case of Susan Smith. Do you remember that case?
Susan Smith. Was she the one that drove her kids into the lake?
Yeah. So she was convicted of murdering her two sons, 14-month-old Alexander and 3-year-old Michael. So she famously went on TV claiming that a black man had carjacked her, taking her sons. Sounding familiar?
Yes.
So this happened in October of 1994, but the trial was in 1995. So this was 1 year prior to the murders of Devin and Damon. This tragedy was fresh in the minds of the public, and this may have played into the way Darlie was framed in the media. There was also Diane Downs, who used the same excuse of carjacking. This was in 1984 that she was sentenced, but it's possible that these two cases factored into the way the public perceived Darlie and the way that the jury perceived her.
Yeah, especially with Susan Smith being so fresh in their minds, I could see how that could definitely play a part.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like just so close in time and being all over the newspapers, the shock and awe, this mother who was capable of murdering her children, you know, how could she? What a quote unquote monster type thing. And then you see somebody like Darlie, and I think she's an easy target. I'm not saying that they're wrong, but I think that she was an easy target given the fact that, you know, her and Darren were said to be very out there with their lavish lifestyle and purchases and Darlie's bleached hair and augmented breasts, which I think is such a ridiculous thing, but it needs to be said because it's something that's brought up by even the jurors. So it's a real point that is emphasized over and over again. Like, I hate bringing up the appearance of somebody, you know, whether it's a victim or a perpetrator, but here it is incredibly relevant.
It is, and especially for the time, because, you know, nowadays we don't really put too much emphasis on a girl that has her boobs done. But back then, it was a little less common.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And maybe in this area that she was in, it was looked down upon even more. Like, the area that the trial was held, it seemed to be very conservative. And then you have somebody who's very different from you. And this jury just did not represent Darlie's peers. And that just feels so unfortunate because even from the get-go, she's not going to get a fair trial.
Yeah, and she clearly didn't.
The cases of Susan Smith and Diane Downs are just one more thing we need to consider. It's sort of this normalization of mothers killing their children, sort of like the satanic panic, where these ritualistic satanic murders were portrayed as common, when in fact they're extremely uncommon and not a pervasive problem as the media had many people believe. The media is one of the key players in this trial, and its impact on Darlie and where she sits today is still discussed frequently. This is truly a confusing case with so much contradictory information. And after so much research, I'm not really sure definitively where I stand on Darlie Routier. If I believe one way or the other, there is, in my opinion, at the very least, grounds for a new trial, and there was reasonable doubt. What are your final thoughts on the case, Dana?
I'm with you on that. I 100% agree with you. Like, I'm not totally convinced of her innocence. However, this is a woman that is sitting on death row. I should be 100% convinced of her guilt, and I'm not.
Yeah, like, I think if you were to maybe have this in civil court where it's, you know, greater chance than not, right? Preponderance of evidence, it's different standard, a different burden of proof. I think maybe it would meet the standards in civil court, but in criminal court, I just don't believe that they've met their burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. I think that there was bias on the part of the investigators, on the prosecutors. There was a lot of shaming and othering going on. And the fact that, I can't remember the small town in Texas, what it was called, where this trial was held, that was not a jury of her peers. And you've got all of these conservative people who are then judging her, and they've already got these preconceived ideas about her. So I just think she was set up for failure from the beginning. Whether guilty or innocent, I can't 100% say for sure. I just think it's such a travesty of justice that she didn't get a fair trial.
She absolutely did not get a fair trial. And again, she's on death row. Like, you convicted her and sentenced her to death. And there are so many unanswered questions. That just doesn't seem right. Like, we are in America. This is supposed to be a fair place to be put on trial. And it very clearly is not.
Yeah. And I think that's what's so disappointing is we like to hope that the justice system endeavors to be fair. So when we see all of these egregious errors, we see these detectives pleading the fifth, we see the court transcriber pleading the fifth, you're like, what is going on here?
That, I have said it several times in this episode, it blows my mind. Like, I just cannot wrap my head around three people pleading the fifth and no red flags were raised.
Yeah, that's just, it's like, okay, yeah, we've investigated ourselves. It's all good here. Nothing to see here. No new trial for Darlie. It just seems such a shame that if she would have got a fair trial where all of this evidence was put forth and the jury was able to see everything for what it was, then I think it would have been much more likely. And you might have had some of them who feel the way you or I do. They can't tell one way or the other. And, you know, if I was sitting on that jury, knowing what I know, I couldn't convict based on the evidence. That's all I know.
I'm with you on that. I don't think that I could either. There's just too many questions. There's too many open ends here. They did not prove beyond a reasonable doubt that this woman deserves to be on death row.
Absolutely. So I want to thank Dana for weighing in on this controversial case. Again, this is technically solved, but as we've discussed throughout, there's just so many questions. Dana, do you want to tell my listeners where to find you on social media? And on a side note, might I add, Dana's a big deal on Twitter. How many followers do you have on Twitter?
I'm somewhere hovering around 45,000, I think.
She's got a lot.
Yeah. And my Twitter is at Trophy Wife Dana, and Dana is spelled D-A-Y-N-A because I'm extra. And all of my links for my podcast, my two shows, That Trophy Wife Life and The Dirty Little Secrets Club, can be found there also.
Definitely go check out both shows and follow Dana on Twitter because she's really, really funny.
Thank you.
I want to thank everybody for listening to part two of our main episodes on Darlie Root here. Stay tuned for the expert episodes that will be coming in the following weeks. So I just want to let everybody know that Dr. Ashley Wellman and I now have a Patreon. So there isn't a Patreon for Riddle Me That or for The Path Went Chilly. So on this Patreon, we will have at the $10 level, One Path Went Chilly mini. So it'll be around an hour. So Robin will be jumping on and helping us out with that. And then at the $5 level, there'll be one Jules and Ashley, which will be either Ashley telling me a story or me telling Ashley a story. And it will be solved, unsolved, conspiracy theories. So it's going to be a lot of exciting stuff. I'll link it in the show notes as well as both of Dana's shows. So you can check out The Trophy Wife Life or The Dirty Little Secrets Club. Thank you for listening. Until next time, stay safe and remember, accept nothing, question everything.
Hey guys, did you know that you can burn up to 40 calories for every 15 minutes of laughing? Get in shape with That Trophy Wife Life. We are a comedy podcast that guarantees to make you really, really, really good looking. Join us as we discuss hard-hitting, important topics like asshole kid moments, the best drunk stories, best pranks ever pulled, and the dumbest criminals that get themselves busted. So if you want to lose weight and be really, really, really good looking, find That Trophy Wife Life today. Available on all major podcast platforms and YouTube. Don't forget to rate and review. Only 5 stars are being accepted at this time. And until our next episode, keep living that Trophy Wife Life.